You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. There was an old broken-down Ford farm truck rotting away in one of my mountain meadows. Or not rotting, as I believed it had stopped, ceased, and foreclosed upon itself. There was no insignia on the exterior marking the truck as a Ford, but it had the proud and overdressed look of those early Model Ts, with the top hat roof, hoopy skirting fenders, and vaudevillian front grille, as well as the pleasingly cathedral-style hood. But from a distance of perhaps 15 feet across the driver door, I believed I could make out the splash of some raised lettering which looked to spell out the word Clumpster. And so I called it and thought of it as such, as the old Ford Clumpster in the Petapan field. It is perhaps an illusion, or the rare disclosure of truth, or just some mistake of my own issue, but the Ford Clumpster seemed, through rusting, to have fumbled into a kind of super-dense, super-extraordinary metal, almost rock-like in its resistance to my knuckles, as though it had managed to conquer the nature of its original composition and become some kind of ambitiously new metal, where once it was made of steel and iron and whatever alloy, it was now become, after 50 or 70 years, some new resurgent form, a magma as hard as stone, and with the deep cold presence of a boulder. Lending my hands over the rounded hood and the brim of the cabin revealed a rough, uneven surface. Blindfolded, I would have guessed it was some kind of enormous, ocean-polished stone. Not at all something man-made, let alone a vehicle. Such was the wild flow of the truck's altered skin. I imagine, though I do not know if it is possible, that the thoroughgoing rust had been itself beset upon again and again by the oxidization process, that the Ford Clumpster had rusted, and that the rust itself had thereafter rusted, and perhaps even again, and that this second or third rusting might have begun to galvanize into a new metallurgic state. I do not myself live side by side with science, and rarely do I retrieve the purported truth from whatever available books, despite promising myself visits to the library. But I did discover, quite by chance, in an armchair science article in the local Lemon newspaper, a happy description of rust, which read, "Rust has a higher volume than its originating mass, and therefore tends to force itself apart. This phenomenon is known as rust-jacking." On the occasional boyish day, I would make my way out to the Ford Clumpster, as though to discover how and why it had arrived in my field. I have always enjoyed misplacements, for there was no reason for the vehicle to be so far up the mountain, and so again tossed outwards into the useless Petapan field. The tires were obviously disintegrated, and the hood was weathered shut. Through the gaps in the front grille, I could see a hollow space where the engine once was. But the doors worked, and there was glass in every window. I could therefore sit inside the Clumpster, hands on the old black wheel, and if the wind blew fiercely enough across the Petapan weeds, one could enjoy the beneficial illusion of driving. And in such daydreamy moments, as I imagined myself driving the old Ford, I would best speculate on its enigmatic arrival here in my field, as however many years ago, some farmer or other, with his load of stones, or logs, or grain, or with some other mysterious purpose, had come to his sad halt. Maybe he'd died in the truck, slowly tipping like a potato bag over to one side. Maybe he had no family, and thus no heir to reclaim the vehicle. Or, most obviously, the truck had simply broken down. Maybe there were plans to fix it, but parts could not be secured, or were too expensive. Or the problem could not be diagnosed. And he'd gutted it instead. Let it go trickle back over 1,000 years to the minerals, and dive ever so slowly down into the culling earth. Leaving the clumpster, I would feel the pleasant small nagging tingle of the mystery. I would never know how the Ford came to its resting spot. I would never meet the farmer, never know what he hauled in the back, what his life was like, what he was after, where he was heading, how he'd got here, and especially, why. Whether there was some old road along here, or that he'd just drove himself up and about the mountain meadows, following his own desire, some old sporty headcase from 1923. But then again, one understands that one's own life unveils the same wide mystery, that none will know us by our real substance, or even when finding our scattered pieces, that none will be demystified by such facts. There is only the struggle to know, to kick and touch at our remnants strewn about and wonder, if only for a moment, what went on here, and who was this, and why. And in the best light, perhaps, we can say, after the farmer died, he went down into the dirt. And after a time, his old dust rose into the sky and spread outward into the clouds. And after a time, he came back down again in the fingertips of the rain, where he splashed heartily against his old Ford clumpster, which will sit for its span in the Petapan field before itself finally glittering away into the dirt.
Oh, the sun falls strangely through the sea. Whisper, pray, and sing to thee, remember thee.
I had only just moved to Lemon, New Hampshire. I was freshly retired from 40 years on the stage. I'd found a beautiful, if run-down, cabin on top of Market Mountain. I had a view of the village. I had cliffs and a mountain brook. After my first week installed, a hailstorm came, white rocks clattering at the shingles. The strange original condition being that my roof at the time had a great hole in its peak, where the cupola had blown off. But I woke to what was, to my ears at the moment, the sound of hammering. The pleasant sound of men fixing my roof, so I thought. How long will it take them, I wondered, as I moved into the kitchen to make tea. I will make us all tea, I thought,
commending myself on my beneficence. That will be the kindness that I do. A public nicety. An offering. Every month or so. A charitable act. A hitchhiker. An old lady lost on the sidewalk. A poor man with his hand out. I will help. Not often, but sometimes. Infrequently, but steadfastly. I was having trouble remembering hiring any roof crew, but I rustled at the sink with my sleepy self, trying to recall the order of things. Loose tea, kettle, sugar, water, cups. When I saw through the sink window, the baseballs bouncing around in the field. A moment later, of course, I understood it was a hailstorm. Rare intrusions like this are unsettling. Earthquakes, tornadoes, comets, hail. Because there is a punishing lack of familiarity, even if pleasantly observed, any event or thing that arises from the special expression of circumstances will shock. And anything that shocks will deposit, as a part of its overall drama, a residue of darkness. So hail was falling. Great fleshy knobs of it, and my heart sank. I was bereft, thrown from the safe boat of rain or shine. How can something that so rarely happens happen at all? Nevertheless, the cold stones plummeted from the sky, denting my car, squashing flowers flat with mean, atmospheric fists. This was a malignant, a murderous hail. I imagined animals in the woods, deer and buffalo if they persisted, being pelted and lying injured, bleeding out near the streams. A plague of ice. At any rate, mood and dream followed mood and dream, and after my initial impression of workmen on the roof, and my subsequent stabbing depression from the instability of the world as I knew it, I had only one giddy desire. I must get myself outside and into the smashing hail as quickly as possible. Protected, of course, safe, but inside the berserking ride of it, with it all around me falling and lobbing and bouncing, as though I were being attacked by the clouds. I knew it wouldn't last long. Strange things never do. Ghosts, monsters, earthquakes. Brief massive shifts toward the very edges of the possible are always composed of a gossamer stuff. So I made my way quickly into the bedroom. I had an old Australian weather beater that I never wore, but could not part with. It seemed to be tailored from some kind of dinosaur pelt. It was ancient and thick, and needed no hook to stand like a shovel against the wall. It was heavy and somehow disgusting, but I knew it would be the perfect shield. Yet I had no hat. I did not know if hail fell ever in daggers or swords, but one rock ice to the head would do me in. I returned to the kitchen, searching for my helmet, and as I fished around my cupboards, my eye was caught. Out near the old Ford Clumpster, I saw brown and white, something or other, tearing madly around. Was it a puppy? Some strange, furry, air-filled bag? A jackrabbit? Even a cat of some kind? It was moving so feverishly and floppingly that I could neither tell how large it was, nor really much in the way of the detail of its shape. "Get under the Clumpster, you idiot thing!" I yelled, tapping at the kitchen glass. And no sooner had I said it than a boot of ice came stomping down into the little weirdo's body. He lay for a moment under a shellac of ice particles before magically shrugging it off and resuming his maniac circuit, running from the trees to the rock wall, to the birch stand, to the Clumpster, all while doing little loop-de-loops and forward tumblings. I could not tell whether the animal was insane with the hail or celebrating it. I took a metal batter ball from the cupboard and checked its fit. It sat well over my head, but would fall unless I held it in place. I pictured the ice chunks striking hard into my exposed knuckles, and without a second thought, I took a slice of bread from the table loaf, wet it at the tap, and then packed it, like a mortar, into the base of the bowl, before setting the whole schlock down onto my head. A comfortable fit, however much a dunce cap. And thus I ran out of the cabin and into the ice storm, protected, primarily, by the impromptu bread hat, toward the old Clumpster, to rescue the furry bag creature. It sometimes happens this way, that barely any of the believable world is retained in one's reality. It is my experience that these things usually are contagious. Where one strange thing occurs, more strangeness follows, until there is nothing remaining but strangeness itself. I felt the small pats of the hail at first, but instead of rejoicing in the bizarre world of the deadly ice balls, I now felt in the sway of an emergency. There was a compulsion to communicate my warning fears to the puppy, kitten, rabbit, mongoose, or dwarf cow, whatever it was. It needed saving. Or, perhaps, it needed nothing, and it was I who was under the influence of some Samaritan spell. I was, after all, in the mood to help. I had put forward that energy, but had not yet found a receptor. Hail shot at the earth, whizzed off my shoulders and pinged at the metal bowl on my head. There was a sparkling hum in the air, as from the high conduit wires that carried electricity into town. The world does not often appear actively violent or ungainly, but hail created such a scheme. Snow and rain were both beautiful. Hail was rather silly and did a hooligan's damage. Thus, as I ran, I felt more within the throes of a man-made ruckus, an exploded parade, a rioting demonstration, rather than anything the world itself had proposed. How did hail even happen? How could such heavy masses form without their smaller, integrating pieces falling prior to the enormous coalescence? I must find out about hail, I thought, secretly suspecting that it might be an impossible formation. I must get to the library. So many things to check that remained unchecked. I was about halfway to the Ford Clumpster, zigging and zagging as I was, and cramped down as though running continually beneath the blade of a helicopter, when I realized that the furry bag creature had been hit again, and this time with sterner result. It was motionless in the grey weeds about 10 feet from the Ford. I straightened up into the imaginary helicopter blade and ran faster toward it, and as though the blade were demonstrating its power, the helmet flipped suddenly back. I stumbled in the simultaneous ambition of wanting to go back and fetch the helmet, while knowing that I must go forward. Part of me halted, while the rest moved on. There was no time. Ice rocks were driving into the little animal, and somehow movement gave me the illusion of safety. Even as I approached, I could not identify the animal. It was an amorphous wet towel without an obvious head. I grabbed it into my arms, tore open the Clumpster's heavy door, and jammed us quickly in. I set the animal on the passenger seat and caught my breath. Instinctively, I'd reached for the radio dial as from nerves and habit, but the farm truck Clumpster predated such entertainments. Yet my fingers spun in the air as though dialing up an invisible station, and then alongside the percussion of the hail, there came a silent music that only I and the injured creature could hear.
Deep inside my heart, and it's splintered at its core. Hearts and curdle of milk and pie I adore. It dreams of one breast settling in my mouth to be my spouse. Make a babe and a house. Apple tree, drunken bar, domestically a dirty dog, a dusty pot, a bloody nose, rose embroidered sheets, dangle like women in the breeze, on a line above the yard, and in my heart a flower dies slow, like a campfire covered in piss mellow, like a snowfall. Like a snowfall.
nail hammered with greater ferocity. The cold rocks were no longer bouncing on their merry way in the Petapan field, but now just locked their loads into the earth. I noticed a certain discomfort and shifted. The old clumpster seat was a metal dish with a few rods to lean back onto. Whatever comfortable cloth or feather that had covered it long ago had gone to dust. But I found that I was sitting on a small number of unpleasant shapes, and when I sat up and reached, I found that I was dispensing upon several medium-sized chunks of ice, which meant, of course, that the cabin was not sealed. I looked directly upward. Not only was there a hole in the roof of my house, but there was a gaping hole in the roof of the truck directly above my head, through which the hail had fallen. Apparently, such holes were common to my district. I closed my eyes as an insidiously huge grey tumour of snow and ice appeared, and then strove downward through the hole. A hot phalanx of needles hit my face, and there was a feeling of melt. I opened my eyes. The mass of hail had stuffed itself complete, like a too fat Santa Claus, into the hole not 10 inches above my head. A light forward sprinkle of ice had been my only suffering. A few moments later, as I marveled at the contrasting way in which the world worked, wherewithin which, at first I had been threatened by the huge hail mass, as against how now the mass itself was protecting me from further injury, which all in itself seemed to illustrate the deeper way in which the world went about its operation, of threatening with the weapon it sought to protect you with, of getting so close as to kill, which proximity then extended the only safety. The wind began to whip, and the Petapan field stood its long weeds up against the dampness of the storm. I dropped my hands on the thin black rail of the steering wheel, and the illusion commenced of our driving along through the field. The hail now began falling at the slant, along with the direction of the sharp wind, and the temperature dropped. And as it did, the hailstones grew smaller, and they hit against the windshield like rocks, and then pebbles, until they were next like bits of glass themselves, and then a fine sand, and then again, in the end, whispered down into a beautiful, whipping, falling snow, coming straight for us as the weeds blew, and we flew down over the imaginary highway. In the joy of the dream, I once again toggled at the invisible radio. My fingers twisted the knobless air, and in my head I heard the crying static, the whining, reaching electric scream of nobody home. At least, not quite. I was afraid of the creature in the passenger seat, in the way one is afraid of certain rooms in a strange house. It was forbidding, purely by way of unfamiliarity. It was a foreign thing, and I had some resistance to making my discoveries. As we moved into a longer stretch of highway, however, I took one hand from the wheel and let it down toward the creature. "You shouldn't have come," a voice said. A young woman was seated in the passenger seat. She was perhaps 19 or 20. She wore a dark, heavy dress that looked not to be her own, and her feet were bare. "And why is that?" I said. "First, because I asked you not to," the girl said. "That's not enough," I said. "Second, because you know how my father is." "That's not enough either," I said. The girl grimaced and looked away into the window. "I don't know what you expect," she said. "Come with me," I said. "Where?" she said. "It doesn't matter. It should and it does. I'm not a child. I don't want to run away. I want to go about things right." "We'll make it work," I said. "Where? What will you do?" "I'm not leaving alone," I said. "I can get a job." "My father," she said. "Hell with him," I said. "What would we do?" she begged. "What job would you get? I don't understand what you think. We have no money. We'd be done the moment we ran out of gas." "Oh, no." The girl leaned forward, staring toward the cabin. "It's him. You've got to go. For real." She stepped out of the car, her bare feet on the cold weeds. "I'm not going alone," I said. "You're coming with me." But even as I said it, she was moving away from the car. There was a man in the dark distance now, stalking across the field, something ominous, long and heavy, hanging from one hand. "Daddy!" the girl cried. a voice came across the Petipan field. In the house, her father hissed, and the girl was swept quickly into the wind. I reached to the doors to lock them. I'm not leaving, sir, I began to say. I said it again as his dark blur piked in the shadowy field beside the truck. He heaved up and came down, and punching through the roof above me was a long, huge, sharp, deadly spike. Followed back by the static as the Petipan field brightened and laid down. The storm was over, an inch of snow and ice on the ground. My head was now topped with a pile of frost. Evidently, the chunk of hail above me had finally booked its travel through the roof hole. I touched at the ice on my head, but did not move it. My head felt hot with dreams, and the ice felt good. I glanced toward the furry bag creature, but it was gone. Yet there was a feeling within me of satisfaction. The mystery of the Ford Clumpster no longer nagged. I needed no facts or corroboration of my daydream. It was insubstantial, but it was enough. It satisfied, perhaps entirely the wrong answer, but it filled the space of the answer, and as completely as anything might, which once again firmly established for me how tenuous was my grasp of the entire sphere of actual things, that a passing and cultivated whim could be enough, that what I dreamed up as an answer would satisfy me as well as anything. A long-ago boy had driven his girlfriend home, and her father had struck him down with a pick. Well, yet I knew it was not true. It was enough, and perhaps it was all there ever was.
And you are a waterfall waiting inside a well. And you are a wrecking ball before the building fell. And every lightning rod has gotta watch the storm cloud come. Inside a well, and you are a wrecking ball.
listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.